Welcome to episode 21 of the Field Day Podcast, brought to you by the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. I'm your host, Jordan Haywisher, Director of Water Quality and Research with Farm Bureau. Today's topic is climate and weather. I talked to Dr. Aaron Wilson from The Ohio State University. We kind of go all over the place and talk about the year that was 2019 and kind of short and long term trends and have a very like lay conversation about how weather and climate interact and kind of what we can see in the future. Enjoy. All right, we'll get started here. I guess like I do with everyone else, who are you? Where'd you come from? Where you been? What are you doing? All that good stuff.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Aaron Wilson. I am a research scientist at The Ohio State University. I have a split appointment between the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center on West Campus and OSU Extension in the Ag and Natural Resources group there on campus.
Awesome. So your topic du jour this year is what?
Well, I love to talk about weather and climate. And so this year, the last year and a half really, has provided an excellent opportunity to talk about weather with farmers across the state for sure.
Yeah, so tell us, I mean, obviously everyone knows it's rained and it's been a weird year, but I guess from a researcher standpoint, what's 2019 and I guess the fall of 18, what has that meant to you in terms of what you talk about?
Yeah, so, 2019 presented a lot of challenges all year long, depending on the season. If we look back to 2018, 2018 was the third warmest on record. Our record's robustly in Ohio going back to 1895. And it really, fall was a very wet period. We had a third wettest fall in 2018, second wettest September. And that's really what put everyone behind the eight ball in terms of harvesting and really waiting for that. We were heading into winter expecting El Nino conditions, and typically in the Ohio Valley, that means a little bit drier than average. We had the 11th wettest winter on record here in Ohio, so it was a little bit abnormal for an El Nino year for sure. But we also had some dramatic swings in the weather in terms of temperature. And so the swings in temperature combined with the wetness really caused some problems for forages and stands and things like that. So very clearly, we were able to identify problems that were occurring in the fields and linking it to what's happening in terms of the weather. We got into spring and kind of the hose then focused on west central and northwest Ohio. Some just incredible amounts of rainfall. One of note, St. Mary's, Ohio, over 20 inches of rainfall in 3 months. And just a lot of stations, weather observations across that part of the state, in excess of 15 inches of rainfall, 20 to 26 days of at least a trace of rain during the month of May. And certainly that's what, you know, set in the planting issues across northwest and west central Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, I know we all kind of go out the back door and say and make our weather, you know, observations a lot of times, but I just don't feel like we've seen. I mean, I feel like some of those places like St. Mary's and Saline or whatever got like 4.5, 5, 6 inches at a time. I mean, I just don't feel like we used to see that much. Is that, I mean, how abnormal is that type of heavy rain event?
Yeah, so one of the things that we have seen, a pretty steady, steep increase in the intensity of the rainfall events. If we look back to the 1950s, since the 60s, we've had this really strong positive trend. And what that means is that if we look at our inch and a half, two and a half inch rainfall events, we're seeing more of them. Right now, the latest trends over the last 5 years, it's been about 45 events in 5 year period of at least 1 inch. So you can think that's about 9 inches of rainfall, coming in these 9 days where you're getting that much, a quarter, 25% of the rainfall for the year. So we have seen not only the amount of precipitation increase, and we haven't really talked about those trends yet overall, but we've seen the character of the precipitation change. We have more intense rainfall events that are happening. And of course, not only the increased amount creating more saturated soil conditions over a longer period of time, and then you combine that with a 3 or 4 inch rainfall event, and you've got some serious problems.
Yeah, because I grew up in Western Ohio. I think you're a Dayton person.
Yeah, Miamisburg.
Yeah, Miamisburg. Yep. And so I grew up in Sydney. And so, you know, the trend growing up was, okay, it's really hot. you feel that front coming in. It cools down. You can see almost the line that comes from, northeast or where, northwest. It's coming in. And it seemed like it was always kind of a line of storms. And now these, like, we just have these pockets of like intense heavy rain, and it's really hard to predict, especially, you know, in Western Lake Erie Basin, where, you know, your farmers are have restrictions yeah. on when they can or can't apply their nutrients. And there's times where it said low percentage chance or, you know, less than 50% chance of a heavy rain event, and then they get like 3 inches. And so it's really challenging for any sort of planning outside, you know, especially for nutrient application.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we deal with weather forecasts in terms of precip, it's always a tricky message to get across to the public. The idea that, you know, if you've got a 20% chance of rainfall, it doesn't mean that 20%, you know, are going to see rainfall. It's not like 20% of 100% or anything like that. We're dealing with, you know, how much 20% rainfall for a single county can look very differently, right? It can be 20% of the area in the northwest corner of the county and not the southwest corner of the county. And you combine that with the fact that we're seeing more intense rainfall events, and all of a sudden, within a very short distance, you can have, you know, 6 inches of rainfall falling over a half a mile area, and just, you know, again, a half a mile away, you're not seeing nearly that much. And so it very, very much comes down to, you know, how much rainfall am I seeing on my field? Even we've got farmers that farm across the county, or, you know, in parts of their fields can be saturated beyond belief, and they need water in other parts. And so it really speaks to the variability that we've seen. And certainly we still see these fronts. We had this, you know, this front coming through today with a line of thunderstorms, but during the summertime, we certainly see these heavier pockets of rainfall. And what we typically kind of thought about summertime rainfall, well, we're seeing that later into the fall, right? We're seeing those heavier downpours a little bit later into the fall. Fall really has been the large trend in terms of increasing rainfall. It's been the off season, what we traditionally would think of off season, the fall and the spring trends that have been increasing, not so much in the summer.
Yeah. I mean, that's got to drive meteorologists crazy, right? Like, that's the trope joke, right? It's like, oh, the weather person, you know, is always wrong or whatever the joke is, but sure. It's like their tools have gotten better and better. Their models have gotten better and better, but no one ever takes into account, and maybe they don't care because they're just making a joke, but, you know, the volatility of these mm-hmm. weather systems has to drive, you know, weather people crazy, because they have so, like, they probably have honed in their predictability tool, their predicting tools, and they've gotten better and better, but yet, you know, they always seem to be wrong in a lot of people's eyes. So it's got to drive them crazy.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to unpack there. I think absolutely the skill of the forecast has improved. You know, I mean, if you go back to the 60s or 70s and you want a 5-day forecast, that was going to be very challenging. We do 5-day forecast very, very accurately at this point, right? It certainly, when you get into longer forecasts like 10 or 11, 12 days, which a lot of farmers are interested in, those forecasts become a little bit more difficult. I always tell people, you know, generally here, a storm in Ohio, if we think about a storm system, that storm could be coming off, you know, Japan, and in 5 days it'll be here. Now, that's a long distance to change, to cover, to interact with other parts of the world. And so that predictability is kind of difficult. But certainly that's changed. The other thing is just, now, I've always regarded farmers as the best to talk to about weather data, because if you want to ask them what happened, they're going to give you the temperature to the 10th degree, and they're going to give you precip to the 100th degree. And there really is no other sector that will talk to me about weather that way, and I absolutely love it. But there's a thirst for precise data, right? We talk about precision ag. We talk about that application. And so there is a need to have, I think there's a desire to have a forecast capability that right now is beyond what our forecasting limits are, down to the field level. We're trending there. I'm not saying we're not going to get there. I think that I would like to hope that we'll continue to improve, you know, maybe little by little. But there's a big thirst for that precise weather data to match the precision tech that we have for agriculture. So it's a little bit of combination of that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I think farmers do utilize some pretty high tech, or at least some some weather predictors that are a little bit better than what like your local news or whatever. And I think it was you that mentioned this, and because someone asked you in one of the meetings I think we were in about the sensationalizing of storm systems and like names. Was that you? They're talking about like where the bomb cyclone and like all those. I mean, things that I feel like have always been present but never officially got a tag, like the derecho or whatever the straight line storm systems. And I feel like it helps, you know, lay people like myself understand, I think, and categorize them. But I still think the sensationalizing of the storms is pretty interesting.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, you start hearing it more and more, right? We have a storm system that came in the West Coast yesterday. And so I saw a news outlet calling it a bomb cyclone. Like, traditionally, it was described for systems off the Northeast coast that essentially bomb out. In other words, the central pressure drops 24 millibars in 24 hours, which is just a signal of intense, you know, strong intensification. But we see a lot more of these right now. Polar vortex is another thing. You know, we see these cold air outbreaks in the wintertime. You know, pieces of essentially that polar vortex kind of slide toward the south and the two continents, Eurasia and North America, and it keeps us a little, you know, we're cold. We have the cold air outbreak and all of these other things that happen. Flash drought's another one that's become really popular of late.
I haven't heard that one
yet. Yeah, so I mean, it certainly has a useful definition where you use it in meteorological arenas a lot to describe the onset of the drought. So for instance, here in Ohio, in a year where we had back-to-back-to-back-to-back 12-month wettest periods on record, we had moderate drought conditions over parts of southwest Ohio, the same regions that picked up 15, 20 inches of rain in the spring. We're in drought by August because they only, you know, places like Heber Heights or even up into Dark County, Miami County, where they saw 4.5 inches of rain between July 1st and October 31st. So it's very much describing these drought conditions that are moving in very rapidly. Kentucky was a lot worse than we were. They had a lot of impacts on ponds and livestock. But these are terms, obviously, that once they hit the media outlets, they become really entrenched in almost the modern day weather folklore, I guess, is a way to look at it.
No, that's funny. So you talked about, you know, kind of the counterbalance between having those heavy rains and you had mentioned earlier about the amounts of rain that we're getting. So talk to me, how is that trend of the total precip over a year? How has that changed over time?
Yeah, so the latest National Climate Assessment that came out last year, the fourth assessment, looked at trends and was comparing the modern day period represented by like 1986 to 2016 with the early 20th century. And what we found is across the country, it's precipitation's up about 4%. A lot of that is in the Midwest and Eastern and Southeast portions of the country. Closer to home here in Ohio, those trends over that period are about 5 to 15%. We've got areas that are up almost 15%. So what that means is that every year we're seeing, on average, you know, an additional 3 to 4 inches of rainfall per year than what maybe our grandfathers did in the early part of the 20th century. So that's just, you know, an overall annual trend. But as I mentioned, the two seasons, really, fall trends are up 10 to 15% across the state. We've got a lot of spring rainfall up as well, and even slight winter precipitation up. And then if you look at our summertime trends, a lot of places are flat to even negative trends, especially as we get into late summer, later July, August, and September. We've actually seen flat trends or a little bit decreasing trends. And so, you know, I ask a lot of farmers, what's the worst combination? It's a wet, cold spring, it's a hot, dry summer, and it's a wet fall, impacting planting, impacting harvest, and then not enough rainfall during the growing season. And that's really where our trends have moved. We've moved into that kind of scenario. So, and then that, just the amount of rainfall combined with, more intense rainfall events.
Yeah, I you know, as we were getting, you know, going through such a horrible season this year, I couldn't help but gravitate towards how modern technology made even a miserable year accomplishable, I guess. I mean, I can imagine if we didn't have the hybrids that we did or some of the tools to get out on the field, I just couldn't imagine how many acres wouldn't have been planted this year.
Yeah.
You know, and how would that have even compared? I mean, it was a pretty bad year compared to other seasons, but I just kind of go back to, you know, a lot of people like to bemoan GMOs or even just big seed companies and whatever. But man, I think some of those things really saved farmers' butts this year, I think.
Yeah, and so when we think about, you know, not just what the climate or the weather impacts were this year, it's how, you know, how do we become more resilient to this type of conditions? And certainly, you know, the types of crops, the hybrids that we grow is an important aspect of that. I think, you know, a lot of folks think about tiling, obviously, and how much that might help their fields as well. But then we start bringing in all the other peripheral conversations about erosion and soil control, soil stability, and all those things. I think, you know, the farmers, at least I talk to, understand that this is, you know, it's a really complicated picture. We're being challenged by the weather, but we're naturally resilient. So there's an idea, you know, about using the tools that we have. I think it's a lesson about using the tools that we have to build the resilience to what we're seeing.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. So how is that, you know, do we have data that on how it actually literally affects the amount of work that can get done and the time period that they need to get done?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I last year was looking at the NAS reported fieldwork days, for instance. And if you look at all the months, and that for Ohio goes back to 1995, and if you look at the trends since then, 2 months stick out, April and October. And in those 2 months, the linear trend is down 5 days. So 5 suitable fieldwork days during the month of April and October have been lost.
And that's combined, you're saying, or is that
it's a linear each? Trend? Yeah, each. So 5 in April and 5 in October. So you can think about 10 of your days, 5 for planting, 5 for harvest, really driving the need to shorten those planting windows to kind of understand, you know, can I get into a field and finish in a day, or can I get everything done in a day or two instead of, you know, a lot of times thinking about 5 or 10 days to get something, or 2 weeks to get done. So a lot of things, you know, not just the types of plants, but also the technology. You know, you start thinking about the planters, how much can I get done at once? Of course, if you're planting into saturated conditions and you got heavy equipment, what are you going to do to your fields? How's the compaction going to look? And so it's not, what I like to say is that, you know, I can bring the climate science, but some of the things that I'm talking about now are things that I've learned from farmers in terms of how to apply what we're seeing from the climate to what we can actually do about it, or the problems that are caused. And so that's, you know, when you think about technology and you think about larger planters to get in and out quicker, there's trade-offs. All a farmer's tools are trade-offs. And so, yeah, that's a lot of decisions that farmers have to make these days. Yeah. And we think about, you know, our changing conditions as a threat multiplier. Really what it's doing is it's making our lives a little bit harder. So I always ask the question is, how much more are you, you know, how many more days or hours of the year are you harvesting in the middle of the night because you have to get it done? How often do you have to wait until the fields are frozen in order to get the harvest in? So it's really challenging us to think about that work year and the suitable field work days.
Yeah, I feel like those efficiencies of modern technology are lost, right, to the battle of rain, because, you know, obviously farmers are getting more acres done, either planted or harvested, quicker than they used to. But I feel like it's almost like setting them back to the pace that to which they used to do things.
Yeah, and one of the positives, obviously, you know, as we see warmer temperatures, especially in spring and in fall, is a lengthening of the growing season, right? So we're accumulating growing degree days over a larger portion of the season. But it's a balance between warmer temperatures that allow for planting and harvest versus the precipitation or the conditions of the fields. And so on average, we've gained about 9 or 10 days in the growing season since the mid-20th century. So it's about the same as what we've lost in terms of field suitability, right? And so it is a very interesting comparison.
Yeah, because the one thing I was always hoping, and it happened, I think, not in 19, but the year before, I think, was if you can get your crops off early enough and get your wheat planted and get it to a certain point, it can be harvested earlier than normal. Mm-hmm. And then if you are planning on double cropping beans, you can get that in and get those two crops. So you get the kind of cover crop of the small grain over the wintertime, and then you get to utilize still maybe a more profitable crop on the second half of the season. And I hope we get to the point where that's more reliable for farmers, that mm-hmm. they can depend on that. Because I know people who are just a little bit south of us, in southern Indiana and some areas. I know farmers who they just cover crop all of their or double crop all of their beans, mm-hmm. all of their wheat acres get into beans, and so it'd be nice because I think that is a small piece, or maybe even a larger piece of our water quality issues is keeping that soil covered over the year, and you know, and having a chance to get some organic matter, because obviously a lot of farmers are planting into ryegrass mm-hmm. in the spring, so. I just hope, I guess that's one of my, one of my personal hopes that, we can get into that more reliable double cropping window.
Yeah. So, one of the ways that I like to contextualize, our changes, what we've seen in temperature, and what we expect to see into the future is really what we call like a migrating climate. So if you take what we traditionally thought as an Ohio climate, we see that more like a Virginia winter in 2030 and more like a Southern Illinois summer in 2030. So when you talk about, states or, just south of us, Southern Illinois doing a lot of double cropping, right? Being able to do that more across Northern Ohio, right, than we did in the past and do now as well. And then by the end of the 21st century, we're looking like an Arkansas summer. So what types of crops are we growing? How are we growing? What's the schedule look like? What's the water quality, water quantity issue look like? Certainly, if you look at it, the wet spring, wet fall, drier summer, those types of scenarios, that's really, I think, what we are moving toward preparing for.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think it's hard to wrap, like any long-term forecasting, I think it's hard to wrap your head around the fact that we could be moving in that direction. Yeah. And that's always the rub, I think our farmers are very, like you said, they're very weather-centric. And they understand that, the weather is changing, but they don't want to commit necessarily to the words climate change.
Sure.
Because I think it's just politicized. It is associated with a lot of blame a lot of times. And so they don't want to maybe, no pun intended, hitch their wagons to that sure. type of talk. But it is changing, right? It's changing globally. It's changing in Ohio. And I think that's where your presentation usually resonates, is that we're not saying global warming necessarily. It is, but we're saying this is what's happening in Ohio. This is how it affects you. Yeah. And there's a lot of mitigating factors, right? Because, my understanding is that the global temperature is based on average, not so much you go outside and say, oh my God, it's really hot. Or, hey, it's snowing in March, like so much for global warming, right?
Sure.
So it kind of explained to me what is that temperature focus when people talk about global temperature warming.
Yeah, so I think it's best to start with weather and climate. A lot of things we're talking about day-to-day weather. We get outside, we see temperatures rise, 20 degrees in a day. They cool off 20 degrees at night. And we think, wow, if people are talking about 2 or 3 degrees warmer, what's that really mean, right? But weather is really the short-term, fast-paced changes that are happening day-to-day. Climate is the longer-term period. So it's that average moving over a longer period of time. And so understanding those two, the differences between weather and climate, I think is really important. When we think about the average temperature, I'll give you an example this year. The globe is on pace for the second warmest year on record back to 1880. If you look at a map of the world and you look at the areas that are warm versus the areas that are cooler than average, the only pocket of cooler than average is over the upper Great Plains and Midwest of the United States. On this map, it's the only thing that's blue. Everything else is a shade of red, meaning most of the world has seen temperatures warmer than the 20th century mean this year compared to this single part in the U.S. So if you're sitting in the Dakotas, you're thinking, man, it has been a wet and very cold year. That's your reality, because our realities are wrapped around the idea of weather and these rapid changes and high variability. But all that variability goes into a long-term average, which we call climate. So, for instance, right now Ohio's on pace for about the 16th warmest on record, going back to 1895. So it's not top 10, but the first half of the year was rather cool compared to average because of the rainfall that we were seeing that was helping keep temperatures down. So that's really the difficult messaging, is that what's happening outside our back door, it does not describe the entire situation. And what makes it worse is that areas that are seeing certain conditions happening leads to changes in the overall atmospheric circulation that set up weather patterns. There's a disconnect there. You know, people ask, you know, for instance, I give this example because it's relatively recent. Last January, we had some, probably the coldest wind chills that I've seen in my lifetime. You know, I'm 40 years old, so it's been a fairly long time. Very cold wind chills. You know, we're talking minus 50 degrees, which I haven't really seen much on a map in Ohio in terms of wind chills. But it was a warmer than average winter, right? So some of the coldest temperatures we've ever seen in a warmer than average winter. That, if that doesn't describe the difference between weather and climate, I'm not sure of a better example, really.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it's, I think it is tough to wrap, you know, for some people to wrap their heads around because of just the long-term, you know, trending of it. Because to me, it's like when we talk to people about it, we want to say, okay, this is how it's going to affect you, right? So if your nighttime temperatures aren't dropping below a certain point, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Does that mean, you know, higher propensity for a disease, which would be true, say, like my undergraduate's in turf science. That's when fungus shows up, is average temperature, overnight temperatures above 68 degrees.
Yeah.
You'll get Pythium. You'll get rot. If you have seedlings out, they'll die. And it can happen in 24 hours. And so, you know, there's consequences of some of these things. It's not just like, oh, it's happening and I want to be aware of it, but like, how can you mitigate for it? Can you mitigate for the excess water that's coming in? Can you use your tile system as a weapon and collect and hold and store and do more things like that? And I think those are going to be some real decisions that farmers need to make and maybe commit more time and resources to water holding to make sure that they can provide for that crop while we're transitioning potentially into, you know, a different type of climate.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head with a lot of these things. It's just the compounding issues. You know, you mentioned the overnight temperatures. We are seeing, you know, during the summertime, our daytime highs, if you compare to the early 20th century, now remember we had the 30s, and locally in Ohio and across much of the Midwest, the 30s were a very warm decade, if not the warmest, really, for Ohio. We think about our record heat, summer heat in 34 and 37. But our overnight low temperatures are much warmer today than they were back then, and even on average in the mid-20th century. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot more 75, 76-degree nights, not only with the rot and the wetness duration and things like that, but then how quickly during the day, you know, in the morning, do you go from 77 and you hit 86, you know, and with our modified growing degree crop, you think about it from that framework, things are shutting down to conserve energy. So how much more energy are we, expending at night versus the day and things like that, which are all part of that conversation. And then, you know, as far as the water, yeah, I mean, it's always a tricky thing because we know we will see drought. We saw drought this year. We know we'll see some intense drought again in Ohio. But our trends have been toward, you know, we've seen the wettest 1 to 2 decades on record now for Ohio going back to the late 1800s. We anticipate that even during these dry conditions, flooding is always a threat. Excess water is always a threat. We're a water-rich area. Our weather patterns set up that we tend to break our droughts pretty frequently. We don't have multi-year droughts a lot here. Really not since the 30s and the 50s when we had some multi-year droughts we haven't seen. You know, we think about 1988. We think about 06. We think about 2012. You know, these were intense droughts for Ohio, but they were really short-lived. And so that's more of what we're seeing lately. So the idea of innovation or thinking ahead about how can I store this water when I'm getting too much during the spring, but I don't have enough during the summertime. And of course, you know, I'm never prescriptive. I don't think that there's one single answer to what farmers should be doing. I think, you know, just listening and thinking about, there's a lot of great research. There's a lot of great extension work going on surrounding different techniques and methods to use to build resilience. Less tillage, more cover crops, controlled water drainage structures. All of those have different price points. All of those play into the economy a little bit different. That's why I don't like to be prescriptive, because it's really about the solutions that farmers think is best for their needs. But we need to be thinking about those. We need to be thinking, and I think water storage is one of those things. If water storage and reuse, and how can we tie that into improving water quality and also water quantity? And I think that's an important piece for Ohio to think about.
Yeah, I mean, because unfortunately, when we do have a drought or we have a normalized rainfall, water quality issues, at least in the, you know, as they represent themselves in a bloom or whatever, seem to subside to a certain degree. And so capturing and recycling and understanding the nutrient content of your recycled water and all that, similar to what they would do like in a greenhouse scenario, I think would help alleviate a lot of that, because we know that nutrients aren't getting into the water, less water carries them to water, right? Like it's not, you know, we're not open pipe dumping into lakes or discharging necessarily, but right. It's water that's carrying those nutrients away. So I agree. I think, you know, we kind of say to the point where it's very cliche now, there's not one silver bullet for the water quality issues, but man, one that would really take a bite out of it would be just capturing as much of your water as possible.
Yeah, slowing that progress down. And so, you know, there's a lot of great research that's taking place with Ohio Sea Grant, OSU, Heidelberg, and others on a lot of those topics. You know, we know, for instance, you know, Waterville, you know, this year is just so much along the Maumee in Northwest Ohio, just a record amount of water, actual water coming down. The Maumee there at Waterville, certainly we had a severe bloom, harmful algal bloom in Lake Erie this year, but not the worst that we've seen certainly in recent years, but pretty high on the severity list. So there's a lot we still need to understand about the quantity of water and how it relates to the Lake Erie health and our waterways. But certainly, you know, ways that we can slow down the water, we know that that's important. Some of the interest, you know, we talk a lot about the conservation issues, you know, anything to slow the progress of water, creating these grass waterways, but now let's put some micro lakes within these waterways, within these grassways, the cascading waterways, to really continue to slow that down. I think it's very important. And from what I've seen, you know, talking, you know, a lot of farmers are on board, right, with conservation issues to try to not only improve the environment, but then capturing that water. No farmer wants to lose the nutrients, right?
Yeah.
But we're constantly being challenged by these 4 or 5 inch rainfall events on top of almost continual saturated conditions.
Yeah, and that's what's frustrating, you know, and frustrating from my level, and obviously if you're a farmer, is they have increased their conservation efforts and mm-hmm. decreased their nutrient load over the decades, but yet water quality has gone in the opposite direction. So, I mean, obviously the climate changes, I think, exacerbate, you know, what's going on farm fields, but it's definitely frustrating, I can imagine, for them to, as they have increased no-till acres and cover cropping and all the conservation efforts, and yet the water quality is going in a different direction.
So. Yeah, I mean, we didn't get here overnight, I think, is the issue. And certainly there's still a lot out there, but this isn't just a farmer issue. This is a all hands on deck issue when it comes to water quality. So across the rural to urban gradient, I think it's very important to be thinking about it. And you know, urban areas have their own issues with water quantity, and disease and things like that that can become problematic both with too much or too little water on both sides of things. So, yeah, very much this is an Ohio issue. It's a United States issue. We've got a lot of water going to Lake Erie, but we have far more going to Ohio River, Mississippi, and the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
So it's not just you know, our water doesn't go just toward the lake. We've also just got to think statewide about these issues.
Yeah, I agree. So we'll transition a little bit. What are some of the most common questions that you hear when you presented your slide deck to probably thousands of people this year, hundreds at least? What's one of the most common questions that occur from what your topic is?
Yeah, so one of the questions I get a lot is like, well, you know, we have more cities now, so that's obviously driving the temperature trends up. And what I try to tell people is that there have been a lot of studies conducted. Typically there's a lot that goes into looking at the quality of that data that's coming in, looking at trends excluding urban areas or not excluding urban areas, and all the trends are very similar in terms of temperatures going up? So that's one question, you know, that I get a lot. And, you know, obviously another one is, you know, the climate's been changing for ages. And it's absolutely correct. You know, if you think about Earth's history, it has been warmer in the past, right? But has it really been in a situation or been stable? Has the climate been stable throughout the entire period to allow for human civilization and the growth that we've seen? And that the answer to that is no. You know, and so if we think about those natural variabilities, they're still occurring. But certainly humans have a fingerprint on what we're seeing today, because there are a few ways that we can change climate. If you think about most, when we think about people call, you know, natural cycles or natural variability, a lot of that has to do with how we're moving around the sun, how we're tilted, our tilt change, and we do wobble like as we go through the sun or go around the sun. And so all of those combine to give a certain amount of energy hitting the Earth's surface. And when we've got more energy coming in, we're a warmer environment. When we have less, we're a cooler environment. So right now, the amount of energy coming in should be trending toward a cooler climate, but we're not, right? So what's happening? Well, we're changing the atmospheric composition. We're changing the greenhouse gases. We're changing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, but also the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. And one of the things I didn't talk about, you know, those trends with precip and temperatures and all that come down to the amount of water vapor that we have in the atmosphere. We have more water vapor. It keeps our temperatures during the summer, daytime, cooler. At night, it keeps our temperatures warmer. And then there's more potential for rainfall when these fronts come through to squeeze out that water
vapor. Yeah, because water takes longer to change temperature, right, than like if it was drier, like drier air.
Right. So if we're drier air, we warm up very fast. We think about the Dust Bowl era, very dry. We had very warm, high temperatures. But if you got more moisture in the atmosphere, then your temperatures don't warm up.
Yeah, kind of keeps a blanket. Kind of keeps a blanket on the atmosphere overnight and holds that temperature.
Yeah, that's usually how we think. Yeah. So, you know, what I like to say is that absolutely natural variability is still a play. It's still a part. It will always be a part of our climate. But what we're doing is also changing the atmosphere. And by doing so, that composition of the atmospheric gases, we're changing what the temperature looks like. And then the temperature have all these different feedbacks. There's a lot of different feedbacks that happen.
Yeah, because I remember when you talked about cycles, there was, I think it's the carbon level where it's always kind of gone up and then come down. It's plateaued to a certain degree. And I think you had mentioned that now it hasn't come down in its plateau in its normal cycle that it usually does. I can't remember exactly. Is that correct?
No, absolutely. You're correct. So if you think about, you know, we're here in central Ohio. We were covered by ice at one point. Now, at that time, carbon dioxide was about 180 parts per million equivalent. During warmer periods in Earth history, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is about 280 parts per million. So it's about 100 parts per million swing between the two. And to go from the 180 to 280, it takes thousands of years, right, to do that. Now, 1958, we started measuring it. Charles Keeling started measuring it in Hawaii. He measured around 310 parts per million. This past year, we were over 415, I think 418. So in 60 years, we've increased the same amount of CO2 in the atmosphere as the natural cycles do in thousands of years. And that's the issue. That's the key issue here. Because when the carbon dioxide goes up, we get more water, it warms, we get more water vapor in the atmosphere, and that just feeds an increase in the temperature, and then, you know, it's a cascading effect.
And that's why people are always looking for crops and things that can put carbon back into the soil, essentially.
Sure, yeah, and that brings up, you know, some of these other questions. Well, isn't a CO2-rich environment good for some crops? Absolutely. The research will show you that it's good for some crops. But heat stress isn't, and so we reach certain tipping points or we reach certain periods where the heat stress will then overcome any benefit of a CO2-enriched environment.
Yeah, that's a good point. What other, you know, because this is obviously like a hot, you know, climate's a hot topic. Is there any other, what's like the biggest like myth or misnomer that just really gets to you, you know, like you have a very easy demeanor, very laid back, fairly soft spoken at times. Like what, what's the thing that like your wife has to say, like, can you just drop it? Like, seriously, dude, just drop it. Like, what's the thing that really gets to you?
That's a great question.
Maybe it's not climate related. Maybe it's just, you know, people being slow in the left lane, you know, or.
Man, put on the spot here. I probably have a ton of them, but you know, thinking of, Jordan, that's a really tough one.
No, that's fine.
I'm sure I have several. I just don't. I'm not aware of them when they're happening.
Maybe you have to phone a friend and be like, "Hey, what's the thing that I incessantly talk about?" Because for me, it's like I have my dad retired from farming when I went to college, so I grew up in that weather centric household where everything was, you know, focused on what's the temperature? How many? I mean, even to this day, you know, our opening conversations with my dad is usually, "Hey, how many tents did you get? Mm-hmm. You know, how much did you get in Western Ohio versus what we got here?" And, well, the weather should be this or that. So it's like, I know for myself, my girlfriend will tell me to stop obsessing over the weather so much as for myself. And even went as far as, teasing me about the weather station that I bought to put outside in our patio so I could have the digital readout of how much rain we have and all that stuff. So,
you know, one thing that does come to mind that's not, I don't think it really ticks me off as much, but what I hear all the time, it doesn't matter where I am in the country, in the state, it doesn't matter. You know, I just don't understand, but these storms just, they always go around me.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So yep. It doesn't matter where you are in the state. These storms always go around you. It has to do with how the radar looks and your distance from the radar and things like that. Or, you know, sometimes they do kind of break up and things like that. But I always find it interesting that most talks, I'll get somebody telling me, "Well, you know, I missed all the rains." Well, everybody can't miss all the rains because obviously it's falling and it's happening. So that's one thing I think of.
Do you like turn all the farmers' almanacs around when you go to like Bob Evans? Do you like?
I love them. I actually love farmers' almanacs. I do. That's another. Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me because I grew up, you know, reading the farmers' almanac and being interested in the folklore and things like that. You know, I had parents that I didn't know him, but in Dayton area there was Gil Whitney. And he always used the woolly worms and the squirrel's
all
nest.
All the indicators.
Yeah. Right. And I had my dad call me, you know, just this year. And he said, "Well, the squirrel's nest, they're either high or way out on the branches. So we're going to get a lot of snow." So I eat it. I take it with a grain of salt, obviously. I think that forecasting has become a little bit more sophisticated than that. But it is interesting. It's an interesting read.
It's so, like weather fiction, you know. Yeah. It's like... I do find it like humoring. It's funny, I guess, but it's because it's kind of like, you know, some of things are going to be true, right? Some of those predictions are going to be true, but obviously not all of them. I would be interested to see what the track record is on that.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Another one that kind of irks me a little bit is naming winter storms. A lot of people share that with me, and I understand why the Weather Channel decided to do it. I should call them out by name, but anyway, why they decided to do it. I mean, we give things names, and then people obviously take things more seriously, like they do with hurricanes. But that, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of turned off by the idea of naming those storms. But I get it. If a lot of people are impacted, then you name them and you
it's easier to kind of historically, you know, date that thing because even now it's like, okay, obviously everyone knows Hurricane Katrina and there's like I think it was like Hurricane Ike and Andrew and some of the ones, you know, when we were growing up that I remember by name because of its placeholder in history or like it just kept being brought up. But I'm not sure if they will quite stick, the winter storm ones. I know it's Sandy was one that I think hit the Northeast. But I don't know. I'm not sure if they'll stick as much as what the summer ones do. But which they should, though, because a lot of them produce school days for the kids. And so for me, I would memorialize those storms if I was a kid and I got, you know, sometimes a week off straight because of a winter storm system.
Yeah, you said one earlier that does tick me off a lot. And it's okay. And it's from, you know, not understanding those differences. But you get a big snowfall and you say, "Well, there's no global warming." That does get under my skin a little bit. I try to make light of it and joke of it. I gave a talk when we had the big cold out air outbreak in the early part of November, just really, really cold conditions, about a week and ahead of anything we've seen in the past. We broke a lot of 110-year records. I had to give a talk, and it's like, you know, nothing like talking about climate change on a morning like this, where a lot of us woke up at 1, 2, 3 degrees this morning, you know.
But it points to the extremes, though, right? Yes. It points to the volatility of the weather system, and that's why it's always funny, because, like, by the mere pointing out of a snowfall in, like, March or snowfall in November or whatever, you are observing that the weather is hard to predict, and it's problematic, and it's going to mess up things at times.
Yeah, when we're really cool, when we shouldn't be, I always tell people, check out what's happening in Alaska.
Yeah.
Because 9 times out of 10, it's very warm. So they had a very cold or very slow buildup of sea ice in Alaska this year. And so it allowed for more warmer air farther north, and that cold air has to go somewhere, and it came down into the United States for an early visit. So, usually that's what I tell people to do, but understanding those extremes is important. Extremes are part of the mean, the climate that we talk about, but we know that they're increasing in numbers.
So. Yeah, because I mean, I don't know. I don't get into the politics of it or the blame necessarily, but they just the extremes just hit you over the head. I mean, look what's happened in Melbourne with fires, which I think they said like have pretty much made the koalas nearly extinct because the habitat is just gone, or just what's happened in California with, you know, regardless of if it was, you know, brought on by, you know, electric lines, or I think admittedly there could be a little bit better control of, you know, the brush and stuff. And I wouldn't say it's going to be quite sweeping the floors of the forest that has been mentioned by someone, maybe the president, but some sort of forest management probably could have helped. But those extremes are just hitting people in the face, right? Yeah, you had long-term drought in California. We've had, you know, wildfires and things that are just, you know, going crazy. And I think it's hard to ignore those that are going on, and hard to ignore their connection to those climate variabilities all over the state.
Yeah, you hit two important things that I think are important. Well, of course, I called them important, but it's about a personal face of climate change. We're not California. We're not Greenland. You know, the idea came, you know, that ice is very provocative. It melts. It goes away. It's a visual thing that's really tangible. But when we go to sleep at night in Ohio, we're worried about ice. We haven't had ice here, you know, except for the winter, obviously. We haven't had ice here for a very long time. We don't deal as much in wildfires, right? But California does, and that's the face. So as climate changes, they're facing more and more of these wildfires, right? And so that's the one idea I think that you just spoke on, is that personal face. Wherever you are, there is change happening, and the impacts are very local. The second thing is that, you know, if you think about the wildfires, and you think about, or the opposite of that, the water areas, the water-rich areas that we're in, it really, really is important to think about resource management, right? And we can't be lazy with resource management. How are we managing our water, our quantity, our quality? How are we measuring our timber resources to better prepare for what we know are these extremes that are happening on a more continual basis? So I think those are two important points that you brought up there.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. Do you have anything that I've missed? I mean, I tried to piece together some of the topics that I've heard you speak on. So is there anything that you think people need to know, or things that I've missed?
No, I just, you know, I think it's good to think about that personal face. You know, how is your operation being impacted? Your life, regardless if you're a farmer or not and you're listening, you know, how is your life being impacted by the changes we're seeing, and how might you build resilience so that it's not continuously becoming harder and harder to do what you do?
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jordan.
And that was Dr. Aaron Wilson from The Ohio State University. Hopefully you enjoyed that talk. I think we probably could have gone on for a lot longer talking about weather and climate, but if you need any more information about the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, please visit ofbf.org. And again, please rate and subscribe to the podcast. It helps understand kind of how many people are listening, and be nice to have some feedback. And if you have any topics you'd like to see discussed, please email me at joewischer@ofbf.org. Thank you.